And now, join Kevin Hart as he dives into the minds of some of the world's funniest comedians. This is Comedy Gold Mines with Kevin Hart.
Welcome, world, to an all-new episode of Comedy Gold Mines. God damn, man. Why am I happy? That's the question that I ask myself every day, and I give myself an answer because I get to do this shit. I get to do this shit. And guys, if you do not know the definition of Comedy Gold Mines, I will tell you again. This is a show where I get to get inside the brilliant minds of comedians. And oh my God, what amazing minds they are. And today's mind is so fucking good. Somebody that I was so thrilled that I was going to get the opportunity to talk to. Ladies and gentlemen, I got Bob Saget.
Kevin.
Fucking Bob Saget.
Kevin, you're cutting me deep. I needed this love. I'm so lonely right now. I swear. You're powerful and you're adorable.
Oh, man. Thank you.
Hashtag comedy rock star shit.
Yeah.
You know, heart hustle, hustle heart. You empower me just by looking at your hashtags.
Oh, my God, man. That means the world to me, Bob.
Well, it means the world that you wanted me on this. You got a new damn podcast you put me on.
Yeah,
early,
man.
Early.
I wanted to talk to you. You know why I wanted to talk to you, Bob? Because I feel like you're one of those guys that are in this comedy space that people really, truly don't know. Like, they know you. They know the star of Bob Saget. They know your Hollywood story, but they don't know you. And I wanted to talk to you because I was one of the guys that got to see you perform at a young age in Los Angeles. And I remember seeing you curse. And I was so shocked. I was so shocked that Bob Saget was on stage cussing. Like, it was at the Laugh Factory on Sunset. This is years ago. Years ago, man. And, you know, this is when I was fresh in L.A. And it was so dope to see you on stage. But I was like, oh, shit. Bob is not only, like, a comedian. Bob is an edgy comedian. And what that did for me was it showed me, like, that in this space of entertainment, you can redefine yourself and you can step into so many different lanes and have success in doing it. Because I was looking at the guy that was TV's fucking amazing dad. This guy was a representation of fatherhood on TV. And then on stage, you had like bits and you said fuck and shit. And I was like, he's a comic.
Exactly.
He's a comic.
And my roots were where yours were. I started in Philly.
Get out of here.
I started in Philly at a club called Grandma Minnie's doing music parodies. And I know you started at a club in Philly and then you did an amateur night and then you went up to Boston or something, right?
Yeah, I did Philadelphia for a minute. I went to New York before Boston.
I see.
New York was my gateway to any type of success. But Philadelphia was where it all started to come together. The Laugh House Comedy Club. And there was a place called the New Market Cabaret. Was like, it wasn't really a comedy club. It was like a little space that they could transform into like a theater on some nights. And they would do live shows. And, you know, the comedy shows are where I kind of got my, that's where I got my tough skin. Because that's where I took some serious lashings at the New Market Cabaret.
I bombed the hell out of myself for a long time. I was working at a place called Stars, owned by Stephen Stars. Stephen Starr owns Budokan and a lot of restaurants. And he had a great place and I got to open for a lot of people. But I was, you know, I was gone to Temple University. And your mom, I know, worked at University of Pennsylvania. My mom worked at CHOP, at Children's Hospital.
Holy shit. That was my hospital.
And my nephew had his face redone there. Open with big laughs, but the tragedy, man, that's where it comes from, is tragedy.
When did you start, Bob? What age? What age did you start doing stand-up comedy?
I was 17, and WMMR in Philadelphia had a radio contest at a club called Grandma Minnie's, and I got on stage, a 17-year-old guy, and sang a song about bondage.
Holy shit.
If, you know, people are wondering, hey, Bob got, you know, demented. Is it? No, my dad did it to me. He just did weird comedy because we had a lot of death. And so he laughed at a bunch of sick shit. So here I am. And I won $500.
You won $500. So your first time out the gate, you won. First time out the gate.
And then I didn't win. And then it was a lot of years. And then I would probably do what you did. I took the train to New York while you were in New York, and I would go to Catch a Rising Star in the Improv and wait in line 12 hours, sign the sheet, get up on stage, do comedy music. I hid behind a guitar for a long time. And then once I started getting stronger and moved to LA and went to the Comedy Store, then Mitzi, the owner, made me a MC, and I learned to do time, you know, really 8 years MCing.
Why LA? Why to move to LA? Like, what is it that prompted that? What is it that popped in your head that said, I got to get there, you know, when you were in this space of comedy in the beginning?
I realized I'd weigh 300 pounds if I just kept eating cheesesteaks. So I had to get out of Philly because I was going to be obese. There was no way. I didn't pull on ropes like you and tires. I didn't pull like you pull 40 sled dogs in the snow. Yeah, I see what you I can't jump through tires. I think you could throw the rock. I think you could lift him and catch him on your
I'll
hand.
Fuck the rock up. I'll fuck DJ up. I tell him all the time I'll whoop his ass. I tell him every day, I'll fuck you up if you ever do it. I'll try to do it at least. And if I didn't, I'll bite the shit out of you. It's going to be one of them.
That's what you'll do. You'll bite. Bite him.
Bite the shit out of him. You get to L.A. You're now in the comedy scene.
Well, I got there because I made this movie about my nephew who had his face reconstructed actually at Temple University. I'm sorry, at University of Pennsylvania, but I made a film at Temple University and I won the Student Academy Award when I was 21 years old. The Academy flew me out.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, when you say you made the film, what do you mean? Were you directed? You wrote?
I directed it. I directed a documentary. My nephew narrated. He was 7. And at Children's Hospital, they did a special surgery where they took his face down and they put ribs in from his chest, obviously, and put it in his cheeks. And then I was going to go to USC grad school to be a filmmaker.
Oh, my God.
I got in. And then at the Comedy Store, you didn't get paid. Mitzi said, you shouldn't go to grad school. You should work here for free. And I went, okay. Because that night that I was there, Robin Williams was there. Letterman was hosting. I was like, fuck.
That was your class. Who else was in your class?
Well, they were ahead of me, but they were in my class.
That was your class, Bob. That's your class. You can't say they were ahead of you. I mean, you know, they may have been
they were doing
bigger things at the time, but your success came after, but that's still your core world of comedy group, I would assume, right?
Well, and it's interesting because I always think about this because I was insecure and yet I don't know if you go through this. I don't feel like you do because you're so confident, you know, but I was on stage. I had this comedic demeanor that became more and more confident. Mm-hmm. But I was always a nice guy, you know, always trying to say I said horrible things, but I didn't mean anything by them. You know,
and you say the dark comedy came from your father. The dark comedy
came from my father, and it came from losing a lot of family members. I lost my sisters. I lost, you know, we've had one sister died of scleroderma, hardening of the skin. One sister, mental illness and brain aneurysm. And it wasn't a fun childhood.
How many brothers and sisters?
That was it. I had the two older sisters. So I became an only child. And now I'm just trying to cure the stuff they died from. You know, you do what you can. You do everything you can for people.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the gift.
So is it safe to say that comedy acted as a safe haven, a feel good?
Yeah.
You know, while dealing with the hurt?
Yeah.
And dealing with the pain? Yeah.
Yeah, you know it does. And it's absolutely. And I was doing it 7 days a week all the time. Mm-hmm. And then I would try to get parts and things, but I was on the road too. I would go tour and I was a headliner right away because I did, you know, guitar stuff. So I started headlining clubs right when a show called Make Me Laugh was on. Like people that I looked up to, Robin and David I mean, I was friends with Arsenio. We were on the road together. I was friends with a lot of people. I remember sitting at the back of the room. Billy Crystal came over and just started asking me about myself. And I was talking to Michael Keaton, who was a great stand-up. And Richard was kind of obviously the king. So I would try to know Richard, and I ended up knowing him. And I ended up, you know, being in a movie he made, Critical Condition, and became kind of close with him. Not one of his closest friends, but I went to his house and visited him when he was, you know, and he asked me once, what age did I know I was funny? And what's your age that you knew you were funny?
What age did I know I was funny? That's a great question. I'm going to give you an honest answer. I'm going to say very young, man. You know, at the age, at that age, 8 to 10, when you could start to take over a room. And what I mean by that, you know, at the age 8 to 10, a child has the ability to have not only conversations, but an amazing personality, right? Mm-hmm. Like you, a personality flourishes at that age because a kid is just, a kid is vibrant, you know, they're energetic, they're an energy source. And if you have that, you know how to use it. And at the age 8 to 10 is when I started to use that thing. You know, I knew what came with getting a laugh. I knew the feeling that it gave me when other people laughed at what I did, whether it was an impression, whether it was a funny fall, whether it was a joke, whether it was a gesture, whatever it was, there was something that really lit up in me when people gave me that. And I fell in love with that. I never looked back just at wanting that. And that's, you know, that's where the class clown came from. The funniest cousin in the family, the silliest sibling. Like literally, I can go down the list of titles that I started to get after that age because of the love that I had that was attached to the laugh.
Did you know you wanted to be a comedian? Did you know that? Or because I know you had other jobs.
I didn't know I wanted to be a comedian until after it was suggested. I knew that I loved it. I knew that it was dope as hell. But it wasn't until the suggestion came up of you should go around a corner and perform on amateur night that I was like, oh, shit, you can actually do this.
Because right.
The biggest thing, Bob, like, you know, I hear you talking about when you first started and you went to the club and, you know, you had your guitar and it was a, you know, a night of competition. You won $500. Well, I didn't seek after it. It found me.
Me either. It found me. I didn't think I was going to do it. I was going to be a doctor. Then I was going to be a filmmaker. I still get to do that. I still am directing something later in the year. Mm-hmm. But and now I'm acting in something in quarantine. But we'll talk about that later. But nine, you were right between 8 and 10. Because 9 for me, I mean, you're not right. I mean, you're right for you. But for me, 9 is like I was in my prime. 9 was prime.
Wow.
I was on fire. I could crush. I could crush girls like me, guys like me. I was like, and then about 12, once I started hitting puberty, everything fell to shit. I just lost it, man. I had no mojo. I wasn't funny. I felt like was that this, last week.
Was this life that was attached to it, or you felt like something just changed? Something just changed.
I think I was just becoming more insecure as I became a young man. Mm-hmm. But when I was talking to Richard about when he thought he was funny, we both said 4 years old is when we knew that we were funny, because I was popular at 4, like on the short bus to kindergarten. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it was a short bus because it happened to be a small bus. I just want to be clear. I know. I mean, I can offend myself. I mean, what the hell are we going to do now? I mean, I'm going out on the road and I'm doing it because I need to. But what the hell am I going to do? How long is it going to take to fucking tee something up and then apologize in the middle and then tee out of it? It's 3 minutes in, it's 1 minute in, apology in the middle, and then 5 minutes to dig out, and then I got to write my own soundbite review to butcher myself. then I got to save myself again so I can get the next one out.
You're going on the road.
I'm going to do the Hard Rock in Atlantic City. I'm going in.
You have material? You got new material, Bob?
I had new material before COVID. I don't know if we heard about COVID, but it's been bad. That's my material, Kevin. You know how you get up and you just start going, that's me. I just do it. And I'm so much more conscious of what I don't want to do to hurt anybody. Mm-hmm. So I am careful of that, but I still can't help myself because I'm still that teenager who's going to fuck up.
This is what I'm telling you. People don't know, like for my listeners, man, Bob is raunchy.
You know, it's so funny. I did my last special a couple of years ago and I went to the producer before doing 2 shows that night. And I said, I'm not going to be as dirty this show. I just know it. And then I got off the first show and he said, you're not going to be as dirty? I said, well, next show, I'm not going to be as dirty. But I'm not like gynecologically dirty. I just, I don't know. I think I'm less, I mean, I'm more responsible as a guy who loves embracing the TV dad part of myself. Mm-hmm. But also, those 14-year-olds shouldn't be seeing my stand-up. They should not. It should be 17, 18 and up, you know. And my friends' kids who are 17, 18, they get it. They understand where I'm coming from. But I'm not doing it to shock. I am not.
You're doing it because it's really who you are.
It's who I am, and it's who I came up with, and it's who I know you just had Cedric on. Cedric was on my podcast, and we came up together. I mean, I wasn't having any fun. After I did the video show in Full House, I'd lost my, when those ended, I lost something funny. I didn't know, and I doubt that I didn't love them. It's wonderful. You make the world laugh. I love being able to do television that was for families. You could sit down with your family, you know? Mm-hmm. I still want to do that stuff. There's nothing wrong with that, but people can't differentiate if they think that's you. I mean, it's like Anthony Hopkins is Hannibal Lecter. He don't eat people, you know?
Yeah. It's a great comparison, by the way.
Conan O'Brien told me that Anthony Hopkins does eat people.
There's a chance that he actually may eat humans.
Maybe. Maybe.
Do you still enjoy it? Like, do you still find the joy in stand-up comedy? Or is it now, like you said, because of the times, is it becoming work?
No.
Is it still fun or is it work?
I have to do it. I have no choice. I have to challenge myself. I have to be better than I've ever been. And I have to say something. And I've got a lot to say. And a lot of my new stuff is stuff that I was working on before all this craziness. That was the temperament of the country. Cause I'm a lot older than you. I grew up in Norfolk, Virginia, and there were segregated bathrooms. So I've got like 7 minutes on that. So it becomes more stories that are a little more relevant than I've ever told, more mature, but they always end. I think I need to be, cause I owe it to myself and I owe it to everybody to not just come out and do like, you know, I can't do 90 dick jokes. I can do 80. Or I could do 4 really big dick jokes.
Yeah.
But I just, you know, there are certain things people laugh at. And you know, you do what makes you laugh. And I do the same kind of thing. I think a lot of us do.
Of course. We
go, you know, I'm going to keep going on this.
If you can't have a good time doing what you love, then it's going to be tough for you to continue to do it.
Yeah.
Like for me, I need to enjoy it. I like that I enjoy what I do. And when you lose that, well, it just complicates it. It makes it tough. You mentioned such a great group of comics, you know, like you said, that you were coming up with, that were in these rooms with you, that were in these comedy clubs with you. Who inspired you back then? Who acted as that motivation or driving force to get to that place of success?
A couple of the people who were the greats. When Richard told me I'm funny, and I was like 24 when I met him, or I was actually met him at 22, but I didn't know him until 24. And when he said, that was funny, that thing you did that you were talking about. And I was like, whoa, you know, it was one of my idols. And Rodney Dangerfield did a lot for me. Rodney put me on his first Young Comedian special on HBO. And Rodney gave me good advice, Kevin. He said, and you, this is the best advice I got. He went, like a tank, man. You just go like a tank. Nobody wants to help you. They all want you to fucking fail. You just go like a fucking tank, man. Wow. Blinders on. You just keep going because people are going to try to, they don't want to help you because he'd been hurt a lot. And he changed his name 3 times to get where he was.
I didn't know that.
He was Jacob Cohen. And then he was Jack Roy. And then a club owner named him Rodney Dangerfield one night.
I never knew that. He did it. His reason for doing it was what? Looking for the thing to stick or what?
Yeah, he didn't have the success as Jack Roy and Jacob Cohen. You know, that was like, man, they're going to come after me, you know.
Who else? Was Steve Martin? What about Steve Martin?
I had not met Steve till later. And he's only been gracious to me. But no, I looked up to him a lot. I mean, he was, to me, to be brilliant and silly, which is pure entertainment. So you're making everybody laugh. You're kind of hitting everybody. And that I would find myself laughing because I went, oh, he's so smart and look what he's doing. And then when he started doing movies, it was, well, it's kind of how you fit into movies, you know? It's just an easy fit. And it's and The Jerk was really wonderful. Maybe wouldn't fly today. I talked to Carl Reiner, God bless him, before he died. And he was saying he couldn't make it today because of the, you know, there was racial stuff.
There's a lot in it that people would definitely push back on today. There's a lot of stuff of old that's, you know, historic that are, you know, classics. But if you go back and watch those things today, I mean, there's a lot of cringe moments at the things that we just overlooked as people. And, you know, everything happens for a reason, Bob. I've said it before. I've had some conversations on this podcast where I've definitely said I have no problem with changing and, you know, becoming better. And right. I feel like some of the changes that are being requested are well worthy of it. You know, like we should be more aware and more conscious. So, you know, I'm here for it. I'm not against it at all. It doesn't
make
you think,
though. I agree. Because change has to happen. And this whole year has caused a lot of things to go 180. And it's also made me feel more responsible. Sometimes I do wish I could go back and re-say and redo some things, but the past is the past. All I can do is grow from this moment and impart more love and more humor and probably not as blue, I don't think. You say what you want. I mean, I've never heard someone who's religious say God damn it more than you and made me laugh more with your, and it's not a sacrilege, but you're going, God damn it. And I'm laughing at it. Right. You know who said that a lot? It was Don Rickles, another guy I looked up to. Who also, this is a different time, you know? This is not...
It would have been tough for Don as well. If these times would have been tough. But Richard, too. You talking about Richard. It would have been tough as well. You know what I mean? Bernie, we can go down the list of people.
Oh, I love Bernie. So many people shouldn't be gone. Bernie was... Were you friendly with Bernie?
I knew Bernie, man. I had a relationship with Bernie Mac. And, you know, to the late stages of Bernie's career, when he was finding that crazy wave that he was riding, this was like in the beginning of mine. It's like, you know, when I just started to see a door that I could get through, and me and Bernie were meeting. I remember he was doing a movie with Ashton Kutcher that was called Guess Who? That's the name of the movie. And I remember Bernie was filming that movie, and I went to go meet with him, and we were talking about working together. We were talking about, you know, the day of, you know, doing a movie together. And it's like, fuck, you know, Bernie was gone. I look up, Bernie had passed away, and I'm like, damn, you take these moments for granted. But I was like, I was talking to a legend. I was talking to a legend at the later stages of his life about doing something.
Yeah.
And I was so excited about the possibility of doing it. And then the legend passed away.
And he shouldn't have gone, man. That was a rare disease. He also was so smart and had so much love in him. Larry Wilmore is an old friend, and he was the producer of his show. And I've known Larry forever. And I just, it's the people like Robin Williams. I've been doing this benefit for scleroderma for years, 30 years. We raised $50 million. I lost a sister to it.
You raised how much again, Bob? Jesus.
Over $50 million for research for the Scleroderma Research Foundation. But Robin Williams showed up 7 times over those 30 years. And he would just show up and go, what do you need, chief? And here's a guy, you know, you talk about playing both ends of the spectrum. He would be the family guy in movies. You know, there's nothing better than Mrs. Doubtfire. You know, that for me, you know, I remember when the day of 9/11, every network ran the same footage for 24 hours, but Fox Television, network television, ran Mrs. Doubtfire that night. And I talked to people and I said, what'd you watch that night that we were all in hell together? And I know people that said, I watched Mrs. Doubtfire because And that's what we did. He made us laugh on the worst day we could live.
I mean, Robin Williams is, I mean, he's a GOAT. You know, you're talking about one of the greatest of all time.
Agreed.
From impressions to that actual stage and doing stand-up. I mean, you know, Robin had this one-man show-esque type thing with the performance. Like, there was so much. There's so many levels. Like, when he left the stage, he was tired.
He was sweating so much.
He would
apologize about his BO when he got off stage, because it was, he said, "I'm hairy. Sorry, I'm so hairy. Sorry, I smell." And then he was a one man show if you were on stage with him. I did it a little bit. Like, he would get on stage, and the only way that I could do anything was to dry hump him. You know, that was the only. And then he would go, "No, I'm okay. I'm okay, Chief." And then he'd go, "Ha ha," you know, grab my wiener. And we didn't grab it. You know, it was all mime. But that's just the joy of, you know, when you say his name, people get sad. People just get sad.
Because they just, it was a tough thing to lose. Like, you just named some people that, you know, we were truly hurt and saddened to lose.
Who's your biggest? Who's your biggest influence?
My biggest influence? I mean, Eddie Murphy. Eddie Murphy, yeah. Definitely. There's no way where I can get around the influence that Eddie Murphy has had on me. Dave Chappelle, as of late, has a massive impact and influence on me, as is Chris
I love
Rock.
Him so much. Did you go to Ohio and do that?
Yeah, I went down there.
I did too. There.
How did you like it?
I loved it. I was back there with Chris Tucker, who I know was an influence on you, which I never realized, because you're young. You're a young man.
I'm 41 now, though. I'm getting up there. How old are you,
I'm 64. You 64.
64? You look fucking great, man.
I have the, thank you, but the testicles of a 41-year-old man. They're in Tupperware in my fridge. But I was on, it was Louis C.K., Darnell, and Chris Tucker and Dave. And Dave and I just, we go way back, you know. I did that cameo in Half Baked while I was directing Dirty Work. And Dave and I just, I don't know.
Dirty Work. To my listeners, I challenge you guys to go watch the movie Dirty Work. Dirty Work is pound for pound, one of the funniest movies you will ever fucking see. When I tell you, Norm, listen, when I tell you the humor in Dirty Work was so amazing to me. This world of comedy, this like the not over the top, the conversation side of comedy, where it's about the words, it's about what we're saying. Dirty Work perfected that.
You're wonderful, man. That you want to be in the sequel? We're making it.
Oh my God. I do a cameo all day.
Okay.
I do a fucking cameo all day, man. I'm gonna give you the funniest scene for you. One of the funniest moments in Dirty Work. So in Dirty Work, there's a scene where they're about to have like the fight. It's like the bar fight.
Right.
And he's at the jukebox. He's like, "Oh, we got to put on some bar fighting music."
That's the beautiful Chris Farley.
Chris Farley. And he puts on "If You Like Pina Coladas." and then they start the fight. It's just not the right choice of music for a fight. Clearly the comedy choice there. But when I tell you, there's so many moments like that. There's so many moments that in that movie.
That's the greatness of Norm Macdonald. It's like, I guess you'd look at it like the old Jack Benny movies. There's something where someone just stands there and shit goes on all around him. And he goes, "Hey, what's wrong with that dude?" You know, or, "Hey, homeless guy, here's your $2. Yes. You know,
yes, he addresses
talks,
it.
He talks at people with the title of what they would be. You know, "Good evening, ladies of the evening." You know,
yes, yes, he's fucking brilliant, man. How did Dirty Works come about?
Dirty Work was a script that Norm wrote with Frank Sebastiano, who wrote the original draft, and Fred Wolf. Mm-hmm. Bob Simons produced it. And I'm the first comedian Norm ever saw in Ottawa, Canada, when he was 17 and I was 22.
Wow.
I still don't know how he's younger than me, but that's the story. He's sticking to it.
And he's sticking to it. He's not letting
right?
it go.
No, I think he is younger. And so, I don't know. We had a closeness. You know, we just had a thing. And he thought I was the right guy to direct it. I met with Bob Simons. I met with the people at MGM. And they said, yeah. And the other movie that I wanted to direct that Bob was producing was Half-Baked. That's the other movie that I was interested in. Because I loved Dave and I loved Jim Brewer and Harlan. And I knew everybody, you know.
Did you come close?
I came close enough because Simons gave me Dirty Work, you know, and that was a big deal for me because that was it was a cult favorite. It didn't make money that weekend because that weekend that we opened, we didn't have you've never had this problem, I don't think, although you've been in a lot of movies, maybe back in the day, but our poster for Dirty Work said coming soon. There ain't no date on there. I mean, it's coming eventually.
Nobody knew.
The weekend it opened was the last 2 days that Michael Jordan played for the Bulls.
Oh my God.
That was like, okay, that's our audience, the 16-year-old kids that watch Normal and Saturday Night Live. But since then, I mean, the praise you just gave it is beautiful, man. And I'm gonna hate for the cameo. I'll come to your house to film it.
I mean it when I say truly. One of my favorite movies of all time, man. One of my favorite movies.
You don't even know. I'm lonely in quarantine shooting a movie, and I'm out of quarantine, but you are actually turning me on right now. This is like the best. And I get to see my wife soon, so I'm going to take this, and she's going to get some of it.
You're going to take this energy, and you're going to go drop some dick. Bob is going to drop some dick.
My dick That's dropped years ago.
Said. No. That's what he said. He's going to go. He's going to deliver. That's what you're going to do.
That's going to be time. That's going to be the quote. That's the only sound bite. Bob's going to drop some dick.
How long have you been married, Bob?
I've been married for 4 years. She's a grown-up woman, and I love her a lot. And I got three great daughters that are 34 and 31 and 28. And I have a nice ex-wife. And I got women all over my life, and I have nothing but love and respect. And my kids love me, and they're coming to see my stand-up when I'm in Atlantic City because my daughters and I are they like look at stuff and go, Dad, I don't know why anybody gets out of whack with you. You're full of love on stage, you know?
That's huge.
Well, hey, how many kids you got? You got five?
I got four.
And four kids. How old are they? They're young, right?
Daughter is 16, son 14. Youngest son, 3, and youngest daughter, 7 months. Yeah, I'm all over the map.
Oh, congratulations. God bless you.
Thank you, man.
Is a seven-month-year-old sleeping?
Yeah, she's doing good. Sleeping through the night. You know, I just laugh at the fact that I was almost done and decided to have two more. Like, literally, my kids were about to be at the house. I'm close. I'm right there at the finish line. And then I just brought two more fuckers in here. So Now we're right back where we once were, man. But it's good. It's a blessing. I love that you said, you know, 34, 31, 28. You know, you're at the finish line. Are you happy with the job that you did as a father?
They proved to me that I'm a good person. Mm. That's how I know I'm a good person when I look at them. Mm. And when I get to spend time with them. My two older ones came out to LA during this whole quarantine, and they quarantined. They got tested, so we were all safe during it. And we spent some wonderful time together. And I don't want my wife loves them. They love each other.
What are you shooting now?
I'm shooting a movie. Right now the title is Blue Iguana, but I think it's gonna be called Killing Daniel because Blue Iguana. Anyway, but it's with I think you know Joel David Moore. He's in it.
I know who that is. I do know who that is.
Yeah, he says you know him. And Jason Jones and Mary Lynn Rice Cub and Carly Chaykin, who's on Mr. Robot. She's so good. They're all good. And Iggy Pop is in it.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's a cool indie movie that's a murder thing. A nice R-rated murder thing, and I'm kind of the corporate guy in it.
How are you with work today? I mean, is it something that, you know, is less more for you, or do you like to stay active, stay busy? Like, where are you at now at the age 64, just with the business in general? Like, I know that you've embraced stand-up, and you still embrace stand-up, and you said you need it. You're going to continue to do it because you love it. Is it the same with the acting side of it, or you know, or is that road getting slimmer?
No, I have to do more of it. I think it's going to be my busiest decade. I can't stop working. I'm working on a lot of different projects, an animated thing. I'm trying to be following your footsteps. You're an inspiration, but I can't stop working. I've always been a workaholic, always had a strong work ethic. That's how I was raised.
Why do you think it's still there? Is there a goal attached to the work ethic? Is there an end game for you? Is there a want of I'm trying to achieve said thing? Or is it, like you said, just the abundance of staying busy, gotta work, gotta do?
No, it's more than that. The gotta do is because I want to leave a legacy that is even more meaningful for me. I know that I did family shows that meant a lot to people. I know I've done some stand-up that's meant something to people. But I have other movies I want to make as a director, as an actor. And I want to do stand-up at another level too, and I'm working on it. So I know that I can only improve because I've seen my work. I really want to contribute as much as I can. I know that you're motivated for a lot of reasons, and one of them is you've got a fire in you. I've got a fire in me.
Nice.
You got a fire in you to do it, and I will always have that fire. I know that I will. I don't know if I'll be on stage at 80 years old doing stand-up. I don't know about that. Mm-hmm. Maybe.
What comedian can we say, you know, got to a crazy age and was still doing, you know, hours of comedy on stage? I'm going to go on a whim. You know, is Cosby the oldest that probably was still actively doing it?
Rickles did to 91. So he was doing it. I saw him at about 90, and he stood up once during the show, but it was mostly sit down.
Was it still, was he still together? Was everything still shaping up and matching the way it was supposed to?
He got lost a little bit, but he knew what he was doing. I mean, he still was lucid inside of there. Age is a weird thing. And you want it. What you got going for you is to stay in that shape, to stay in shape so you can get up and walk around on stage. I watch old Carlin stuff, and you see that he went through some stuff, and watch people age through the years in their specials. You know, my next special, I plan to look better. I'm going to CGI my head on your body.
Are you going to do another special?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I got a new hour, so I got to figure out. I wrote a bunch of new music, which my comedy songs are kind of, you know, they're just something I do, and I've always done them. And so they're like,
I love it. I love it, Bob. I love the ambition. I love the drive. I love talking to you and seeing and understanding that you're still very much about this life. You're still like, you know, and this is something that, you know, I can segue into with another question, but, you know, as comedians, there's always the question of, Is there a stopping point, right? No. And it's something that I struggle with. It's something where I struggle with of there being a stopping point. And I don't think I ever want to stop getting on stage. Right. I think that, you know, there's a point where the specials and stuff won't be attached to it, where I won't need to punctuate it with the special or the,
right,
you know, that. I won't have to do that. But you can't just leave this shit. It's, you know, too.
You said it when the door opened and you came into it. You didn't know that you were going to take this path. I think that's the same way we're going out. I don't think we know how we're going to stop doing it, but I don't have any plan to stop doing it. I can't retire. I don't know what that means. I do have one story I wanted to share with you. I've told it before, but it's about Eddie. Okay. So this is a story that is just why he kind of is the best, not to diminish at all that Dave is the best, Chris is the best, Bill Burr is the best. You know, these people are the best. So and everybody preceded all the greatest of all time.
Mm-hmm.
But I was there at the Comedy Store hosting for way too many years. Arsenio went off to do Arsenio, and Howie Mandel left to go do something elsewhere, and I was hosting the Comedy Store. But my reward for that was being with all of these amazing people. So Eddie Murphy came in to work out Raw, and I was hosting in the main room.
Holy fuck. He was working on the material while you were hosting.
I was working, and he did it two Fridays in a row. This is what you're going to love because of how you work.
Okay.
And I know what kind of professional you are. So Eddie comes out. One week he wore the red leather, and one week he wore the blue leather. I don't know which week was which. I don't know what was the magic outfit. But first Friday, he came in. I brought him out on stage. He came out like very, you know, respectful, like a knight in shining armor, right? Comes out, amazing applause at the top. You know what it's like. The walls are rattling, you know, shaking. Mm-hmm. Does the set, gets great applause at the end, does about 50, 55 minutes. It was really great. I told him how good it was. He was like, thank you. And I could just see he was in thought, trying to figure it out, think about it. One week later, and I talked to people because we were all going up at the improv, wherever anybody went up. And I don't know, I don't think he went up anywhere else. If he did, we didn't hear about it because everybody would say Eddie was at the improv Thursday, Friday, whatever. I mean, Wednesday, Thursday. So he comes back the next week in the other outfit. And I'm not saying that's a secret. It's not like an Avenger suit. And he came out and the walls shook when he came out. And he did about an hour and 10. And he took everything that he had done the week before and with different adjustments in his performance and how he was going to attack that set and in how he made it more conversational and added. He didn't pad time. He just made it more real. And it was 5 minutes of applause at the end. You would have thought the building was going to come down. I still have never seen anyone do what he did.
Wow.
And I said to him, that was amazing. And him being as smart as he is, I had a feeling, I know that he knew that I had hosted him the week before. And he stood there and looked at me with that, yes, sir. Because I could see that he knew how he did it. Mm. And it comes with confidence.
You saw him surgically put it together. Yeah, you saw him put
exactly.
it together.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
You and saw him put the goddamn moments together and come back with adjustments. You were able to witness Eddie Murphy fucking build on what to date is one of the most historic specials ever done.
Always will be.
Yeah, if not the best. I will say, I can say, you know, it's definitely an argument of that being the best ever done. Chappelle has made a case for, you know, a conversation with some of his last ones that he's done. Sticks and Stones. Personally, I put it above the Raw now, but Raw's right there.
I want to marry Dave Chappelle. I'm so in love. I say shit to Dave, and my biggest honor, like you giving me cred, give Norm cred for dirty work. When I say stuff to Dave, I will say it just to make him laugh. And it's sometimes wicked, you know, it's just wrong, but I'm not meaning it. I'm just saying it because it's what's the worst thing I could say? I'll say it to Dave. And then when he walks away and he's pounding on the furniture, that's the biggest compliment I can get, that we're giggling like 9-year-olds. We're
it's
giggling
the best.
Like this. That's the fucking thing for me. That's why would I want to stop doing this?
That's what we do it for. The camaraderie that comes with this fraternity, you know, that we put together. You know, that's what this podcast is for. You know, I'm a comics comic. I love comedians. I love to talk to comedians. I love to hear the stories, man. And that's another thing. Like, I know you talking about that moment with Eddie now. I know you got a shit ton of stories, Bob. I know you've been in some fucking green rooms where you've been in a fly on a wall and have seen and said and been a part of. Like, to me, that's the most amazing thing about our craft. We love to have fun. We love to laugh. And when you surround us with our own, with our kind. Oh my God, it's endless. The opportunities are endless.
My goal for a little while there, I actually, Sam Kennison was a friend. I met him in Houston when he couldn't get it hired because he was a faith healer. You know, he did that professionally. Came to the Comedy Store. I was there for his first set that he ever did at the Comedy Store. And all I tried to do was get out of green rooms that Sam was in, because that would lead to no good.
Sam was wild, right? Sam was a wild guy.
He was crazy.
He was a wild guy.
I was on that first Young Comedian special with him, and Rodney just fell in love with him. And that party after that special, I ended up going back to the hotel, or I would have died.
Yeah you say, enough. I'm going to go ahead and tap out, guys.
Yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and tap out.
I'm going to need this nose for later.
I mean, in that era, you know, that's what it was. It was heavy cocaine in that era. Heavy.
Early 80s. Yeah. I got out there in 78. That's when you were born, right?
I was born in 79.
I was like Pinocchio on Pleasure Island.
Jesus. they said that that era, the comics back then, I mean, you know, that was the go-to. That was the what they did. It's just crazy to me when I hear Richard's stories, and I hear, you know, Richard and everybody's back then. Richard will vocally say, "Yeah, man, we was doing cocaine in the back," and that's when I said, you know, it's just the conversation and the ease of information, like as if it was no problem or no big deal. To me, that shit fascinates me when I hear those stories. Fascinates me. What about John Witherspoon?
I love John.
Were you close with John?
Yeah. He called me Saget. I just love listening to him. I just love stories from him. And one of my best friends when I started, one of my first friends was Gary Shandling.
Wow.
That's one of the first people I became friends with at the Comedy Store. He was, in fact, he had a thing he used to do in his act, how to pick up girls. And you know, and he would act like a nerd, and he would eat Ovaltine out of a jar with a spoon in a bit. He did a bit, and I was the voice on the tape. Well, when one way to pick up a girl is to tell her how much you like her shoes. Boy, I like your shoes. You know, that was the. And then I was close with George Wallace. We were very close. We were hanging
George
out.
Wallace. Wow. Wow.
George was and is. George is hilarious.
Wow.
It's a lot of interesting people. Paul Mooney, I would watch Paul do his stuff.
How was that relationship? How was that relationship with you and Paul?
He was always cool to me, always. Mm-hmm. And because I found him funny. And he said stuff you cannot say. Mm-hmm. But I just found him funny because he was kind of, back then, it was a way of blowing the lid off of what you can't say racially. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he would just go, fuck it, I'm going to say it. And now it's a different... It's a different world, but Paul's still alive and still doing it.
Paul's still Paul.
Paul's still Paul.
Okay, here's a question for you. You land a TV show. That's one thing I didn't ask you. You know, after you land this fucking hit of a show, Full House smacks the goddamn world and becomes the biggest thing on television. What changed for you? You know, did you stay consistent to the craft as you were having this crazy TV success, or did you let it go for a while?
Well, after 1 year of Full House being on the air on ABC, I started hosting America's Funniest Home Videos.
Yep.
So it was 8 years of each. So I had two shows in the top 10, and Full House had a hard go at first, and then so did Seinfeld. That wasn't doing well either, but they believed in shows back then. So they'd keep them on the air if they believed in them. And that was family comedy. So a couple of years in, I started to have enough time because I was writing the video show. You know, those voices. Oh, look out. You know, just bad, badass, boy, terrible voices.
You were part of the creative on Funny Videos as well.
Yeah. Look out. Oh, my nuts. You know, whatever. And it's always the same thing. Look at me. Nothing could happen. Oi! You know, and turn into Jerry. But... But then I would go out and do stand-up, and I remember doing an HBO special that I buried since then because it was they didn't know if I was fish or fowl. And sometimes people still have that problem with what's it going to be this time. Well, it's pretty clear what I'm going to be. Watch the trailer. You'll find out what it's going to be. But I mean, I then really, I was starting to tell you a while ago, I started to really lose my mojo for what I thought was funny. Mm. So I started to play places. I started to do Fat Tuesdays at the Comedy Store. You know what that was?
I know what that was. Yeah.
I'm going to be in
Fat Tuesdays.
Right. So they're making a documentary about it and I'm in it. And I'm one of the few white guys in it because I came up and for 6 months, every Tuesday, I'd call Guy Tori or Joe and I would go up. So I was hanging out with Wanda and
let me make this very clear for our listeners. You know, Fat Tuesdays was an urban night in Los Angeles at the Comedy Store, you know? Well, it was changed to the Comedy Store, but I think it had other homes as well. But
right.
this was your urban night. This was, you know, it was black night, black comics, black audiences. So, you know, Bob is basically saying that for a while he made this spot his home. This is where he frequented it and was finding cover. I just wanted them to understand so they knew what you were talking about. We said Fat Tuesdays. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, when I first got received, I was so happy that I just went, can I keep coming back? And they're, please come back. Cause you're one of the few people that has been able to do this. I had a couple rough nights in it. Because that's the nature of it. That's the nature mm-hmm. of comedy anyway.
Do you feel like you were judged more though because you had the TV success? Like, were the expectations higher? Oh man, Bob's coming in. So we're expecting Bob to come in and do blah, blah, blah because Bob's got all his fucking success. Bob's coming in with all his TV success.
I didn't address it that way. I was incredibly humbled because I felt lucky to be able to be part of it. And I wanted so badly to be part of it. And so I was emotional about being there. And I think that's why I was able to do it because I was honest. And mm-hmm. sometimes I did pretty well sometimes. And they would go like, the audience laughed. I mean, you know, they were digging it. So I'll never forget it. I mean, it helped. I think it gave me this fake badass thing that I started doing that was me. But I went, no, there was a while, I this is not going to be a good sound, but I just wanted to be black. There were many, how do I say that, Kevin? Get me out of this. How do I do this?
Well, you didn't step in shit. You're not saying anything. You didn't say anything wrong.
Well, all my favorite comedians were black, except for, I don't know. And so I'm still digging a hole.
Give me a favor. You're not digging a hole. I would tell you if you were digging a hole. Give me your three. Give me your three.
Well, I got to say you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it.
Comedic rock star shit. Hustle Hart. I would say Dave and Chris and Eddie, mm-hmm. Richard. I mean, I absolutely.
I don't think what you said is wrong. I mean, I think it's not a bad thing to be influenced or a fan of. You know, you're talking about a culture that you embraced and that embraced you back. So your comment wasn't one of disrespect or something where it's, oh, fuck, what the fuck did Bob do? What is that? So when you
right.
say,
right, it's just the opposite of that from intention.
Yeah, no, it's one of love, it's one of embrace. So there's no hole to dig yourself out of. You didn't dig yourself a hole, Bob. You could.
Thank you.
I would tell you if you weren't.
Well, I also love Jerry. I also look at Jerry and I go, holy shit, how did he do that? Unbelievable. How do you hone that? And Bill Burr to me is one of my favorite people on the earth. It was funny. I was talking to Bill. You'll like this because I know you like Bill and Bill loves you.
I love Bill.
I know. And it's hard not to because he does this thing. And I say to him, it's a metaphor for me that I said, Bill, you dive into a swimming pool with no water in it. And then you somehow get out. You just don't know how you do it sometimes. And I was sitting, we were smoking a cigar in my yard, not long ago, actually. And I was trying to inhale as much as I could in case he had COVID. And and I said, you know, Bill, he says, well, what do you, he asked me kind of what you're asking. You know, you're 64. What are your plans? I went, well, I don't know. I don't feel like I've come here. I haven't done what I've come here to do yet.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at me and he said, well, you better fucking hurry up.
You better figure it out, Bob. Jesus Christ.
You ain't no kid, Bob.
No, man. Bob, I'm gonna tell you this, man, and I really do mean this. Dude, it's so dope. It's so dope to not only talk to comics, but comics that I simply respect and appreciate. And you know, as I'm wrapping this up, man, I want to tell you, I have a high level of respect and appreciation for your journey, your story. Like I love the story of a climb, right? And this profession that we've chose, it allows us to go through so many different peaks, hills, valleys to get to different levels of success. And that success can be different for each and every single one of us, right? Yeah. It's not all the same. We all reach a different piece of it and get to touch it in a different way. Yeah. And I respect that. I appreciate that. And now you sit at the age 64 and you're still talking to me about going back on the road, doing another special, you're filming a movie, you're talking about your passion and love for directing. It's something that makes me go, man, I can't wait to get there, right? I can't wait to be at that age and still smile and enjoy the craft of comedy. And that's what I take from this conversation, man. You still enjoy what you do. You still have a love
for pure this love,
craft, man. Yeah.
And that's you special, always Bob. Will, Kevin. You're so special. You got, I'm not doing the lick each other up and down in show business moment, but you're very, you're a very special guy. I mean, the energy and the joy that you have, and you can be serious as hell. You'll be doing dramatic work. I know you will, but when you want to, but you're such a fun force. It's so funny how much energy you come at the world with. And that's, I just fucking love it. It's just, man. It makes me happy. When I was asked to do this, I was honored and I was just really happy because you make me, this is going to sound so fruity. You make me smile. I'm going to swipe right.
Hey, man.
Let's go on Bumble. I don't know what we got.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Comedy Gold Mines. And we get inside the minds of comedians. Oh my God, what amazing minds they are. And today's mind was no different. Bob Saget, ladies and gentlemen. Bob, I appreciate you for allowing me to talk to you, man. This is just open dialogue. There is no roadmap to it. It's conversation. And I swear to you, man, I thoroughly enjoyed today's. Thank you so much. I meant everything that I said to you, dude. Keep on doing what you're doing. Keep being an example for this younger generation that, you know, when you find something, it's good to grab onto it and hold on to it and love it forever. That's what you're doing, man. You're loving it for fucking ever. Bob Saget, ladies
and
gentlemen.
Thank you, Kevin.
All right, Bob.
Thanks, Kevin. Love you, man.
Love you back.
Comedy Gold Mines is a Sirius XM and LOL audio production. Executive produced by Kevin Hart, Ty Randolph, and Eric Weil. With Tastemakers Media, Emil Garner, and Ian McDonald.